This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A few days after the September 11th attacks, President Bush said about the American response, "This crusade, this war on terrorism, is going to take a while, and the American people must be patient." His use of the word crusade outraged many Muslims. The new book Warriors of God explains why. It's a history of the Third Crusade, written by James Reston Jr. He's also the author of The Last Apocalypse and Galileo. There were five major crusades. Reston writes, "The crusades stretched over a period of 200 years, unleashing a frenzy of hate and violence unprecedented before the advent of the technological age and the scourge of Hitler. The madness was initiated in the name of religion by Pope Urban II in 1095 to redirect the energies of warring European barons from their bloody local disputes into a so-called noble quest to reclaim the Holy Land from the people they considered infidels. Once unleashed, the passion could not be controlled." I asked Reston to explain more about why the president's use of the word crusade got such a negative reaction.
Well, that was probably the worst thing that that Bush could have said, because the Crusades are remembered to Arabs almost like the Holocaust is remembered to the Jews in Israel. You remember when the Pope went to Israel several years ago. The big question in Israel amongst the Jewish community was whether or not he would apologize for the Vatican complicity in the Holocaust, which he did in a manner of speaking. But the Palestinian community was waiting to see whether he would equally apologize for the Crusades. And it's, I think, for a Western audience, very unusual and almost unbelievable that for the Arab world in general and the Palestinians in particular, that the Crusades of the 1100s through the 1300s are remembered almost as vividly as anything else in their history. And it's remembered, of course, as an attack and an invasion by Europe of the Middle East, in which a great many tens of thousands of Muslims were massacred. And in the very first crusade, which captured Jerusalem, the Christians came over the walls of Jerusalem and proceeded to slaughter many thousands of Muslims before they dropped on their knees in the Holy Sepulchre and gave thanks to Christ. So the notion generally of a Western crusade against Arab peoples and the Middle East is probably the worst image that could be evoked.
Your new book, Warriors of God, is about the Third Crusade. What was that crusade about?
Well, the First Crusade, which captured Jerusalem, put into being a state called the Kingdom of Jerusalem, which was not all that much bigger than the current state of Israel. It was a little bit larger, but basically had the same configuration along the coastline. And from the Arab perspective, the era of history after the capture of Jerusalem and the establishment of this European state, the goal was to consolidate Arab forces in Egypt and in Syria to surround this kingdom of Jerusalem and recapture for Islam their native land and their holy sites, because of course Jerusalem is just as holy to Islam as it is to Christianity. And what happened was that under the great Arab leader Saladin, in fact the Crusaders were defeated, and Jerusalem was recaptured for Islam. And that sent terrific shockwaves through Europe, the loss of Jerusalem and the collapse of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And that's what made Richard the Lionheart fall to his knees, and all of Europe mobilized for the Third Crusade.
The Arab army under the direction of Saladin had seized the True Cross. What was the True Cross? What was its significance?
Well, of course, this was thought to be the True Cross, the cross that Christ was crucified upon, and it was there's great controversy as to whether it really was the true cross or whether these pieces of wood that were kept in the Holy Sepulchre actually were the true cross that Christ was crucified on. At any rate, the Christianity at the time thought it was, and they would trot it out when they had a great battle against the Muslims, and it had always worked up until the year of 1187. It seemed as if whenever the true cross was brought onto the battlefield by the crusaders and the Christians, that they always won their battles. Well, they didn't win the one in 1187, and the true cross, or whatever relic of that cross was in the Christian camp, was taken by the Muslim forces, and it became a bargaining chip in the years that succeeded that.
You say that the Muslims then revered Christ as a true prophet, but had contempt for the story of the crucifixion. Would you explain that?
Well, Islam feels that the story of crucifixion is unworthy of a great religion. The notion of a God actually dying in human form and then being resurrected. They believe that Christ that there was a substitute for Christ, and that Christ was not really himself, was not really crucified. They just simply feel that it's unworthy, and they don't believe it as it's told by Christianity.
How important was the seizing of that cross to the mounting of the Third Crusade?
Oh, I think it was one of many things. It's much more important than that, of course, was the collapse of the Crusader kingdom and the loss of mm-hmm. Jerusalem and the loss of the holy sites. The loss of the true cross went along with that, but I think that's a secondary question. It's that, you know, what's going on today between the various religions in the Middle East really has its roots back 800 years ago, and many of these same issues were fought over just as violently and just as intensely as they are today.
How did Jerusalem change in the Third Crusade when it was recaptured by Muslims?
Well, this is interesting because Saladin, while thought of as a great warrior in the Arab world, is also very well known for his generosity and his sentimentality. This is something very much in direct contrast to the way in which the image of Saladin is used today. But when, as I said before, the first crusaders came over the walls of Jerusalem, they slaughtered whatever Muslims and Jews they could find within the old city. By contrast, when Saladin took the city, there was no massacre. And there was a great debate within Saladin's inner circle about what to do about the Christian holy sites. And it's very clear in the medieval chronicles that Saladin basically overruled whatever was being proposed by way of just decimating the Holy Sepulchre and the other Christian sites, and says very clearly that it's simply not to be a good Muslim to defile another religion. And this is this sort of attitude, not only of generosity towards those that he defeated, but it's actually a criticism of him that he allowed the Christians who were in Jerusalem to leave the city and to go north, and in fact protected there these refugees going north, and instead of driving them all completely into the sea. And this came back to haunt him later, because you know the city of Tyre remained in Christian hands, and that gave Richard the Lionheart a toehold when he came.
How did Jews fare under the Christian rule and the Muslim rule of Jerusalem?
Well, the Jews fared very poorly under the Crusader kingdom, very poorly under the Christians, and fared very well under Saladin. I mean, this is another interesting irony in relation to today's world, that Saladin was very generous to the Jews, invited them back into Jerusalem, and had Jews on his staff as his physicians, it's very, very clear from the historical record that the Jews felt very, very well towards Saladin.
My guest is James Reston Jr. His new book is called Warriors of God. It's about the Crusades. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, James Reston Jr., is the author of a new book about the Crusades. It's called Warriors of God. When Christians and Muslims were fighting over control of Jerusalem back in the 1100s to the 1300s, what was at stake for each of them? What were the claims they each had to Jerusalem?
Well, Terry, it's very interesting to research a book like this. Here's an 800-year-old story. Research a book like this in the Middle East and to talk equally to Arab scholars as to Western scholars. It's almost emblazoned in the Western canon that there were five crusades, and everybody's a bit confused about which one was which and what was more important, and they all get kind of lumped together as the same thing. From the Arab standpoint, it's looked at quite differently. It's looked at really as a three-stage process, not five battles or wars. The first is the loss of Jerusalem itself with the first crusade in the year 1098, and the establishment of the European Kingdom of Jerusalem. That's phase number one, that terrible blow to the Arab world. Phase two is an 80-year effort to consolidate these very disparate tribes of the Arabian world into some sort of a consolidated force that could recapture the land which we now know as Palestine. And this is a very slow but quite steady process in which the great effort is to consolidate Egypt and Syria, and then to fall upon the kingdom of Jerusalem and defeat it. That's phase two, that consolidation process, as the Arabs see it. And phase three is the great triumph of Saladin, where that goal is realized in the defeat of the Crusaders and basically the pushing of the Crusaders and the Europeans into the sea. And, of course, that's the reason that Saladin lives so vibrantly in the Arab world today, because he's the great hero that drove the Europeans out.
Was the word jihad used during the Crusades?
Yes, it was.
How is it defined then?
Well, it's defined more broadly than we think of it today. To begin with, it is of its nature a defensive concept. It is the protection of Islam. Now, it has been misused subsequently to refer to the proselytizing of non-Muslims. I mean, the Muslim movement after Muhammad became a very, a very military one, and Islam spread across North Africa partly by military force. But the original concept of jihad is the protection of Islam against assault from the outside.
And that's the context that it was used in during the Crusades?
That's correct. I mean, it was the Crusaders had invaded Palestine, and that was, and had taken that vast area of the coastline there, and jihad was called in order to recapture what they thought was theirs.
Did you go to the Quran and try to read how jihad is used in the context of the book?
Yes.
What'd you find?
Well, it's as about as I described it, but I think also it was interesting to me when I was in Syria researching the book, to find that jihad can also be applied in a personal sense, that one can have a jihad of the tongue, for example, that keeps a good Muslim from blaspheming. And it can be used in other personal ways that attempts to purify the personal behavior of a Muslim. In other words, it doesn't have to always be applied as a national or militant concept for states or peoples.
You did interviews in the West and interviews in the Arab world as part of your research for your book on the Third Crusade. What are some of the different perspectives you got in the Christian world compared to the Arab world?
Well, the central one was what I mentioned before about the different way in which that Crusader period, as we know it in Western, the way Western history is written, how differently that is viewed as Arab history. That's the central thing. Beyond that, of course, the Crusades in childhood lore, and I certainly had plenty of this when I was growing up, is thought to be the age of chivalry. And Richard the Lionheart was very much a part of the Robin Hood lore and the noble, heroic quality of crusaders returning from their noble quest in the East to their homes. All of that was great stuff of, childhood bedtime stories and little movies that we used to see when I was quite young. So there is, of course, none of that in the Arab world.
And do you think that there's still a grain of truth to the nobility of the knights and so on, or do you think that that's really mythology?
Well, it is mythology, but, we love mythology, and more often than not, there is a grain of truth to mythology. I suppose to some extent in the internecine fights between the knights of one province against another, there was probably some chivalry on the battlefield. But when the Crusaders moved to the Middle East, I think the notion of chivalry on the battlefield pretty well went out. Richard the Lionheart, one of the first things that he did after his first great victory in Palestine, when he overcame the siege of Acre, was to pull out 2,700 Muslims out of that city and massacre them. So there's no chivalry in that at all. And actually, if one's looking for chivalry in the Third Crusade, one finds, I would say, marginally more amongst the Muslim forces, and particularly Saladin himself, than in the Christian forces.
What are the ways in which your research into the Crusades have informed the way you interpret what's happening now in terrorism and the coalition against terrorism?
Well, Osama bin Laden no more represents Islam than Jim Jones or David Koresh represents Christianity. I mean, Osama bin Laden is a perversion, an aberration, and we're going through this very sad period in America where it all gets lumped together from the American, particularly white American Christian standpoint. But Osama bin Laden is a cult and a perversion. And there is actually a very good parallel to what Osama bin Laden is from the Third Crusade, because there was a cult at that time also called the Cult of the Assassins. And it was led by a figure called Rashid al-Din Sinan. And the Assassins had a territory deep in the mountains of Syria, and they basically terrorized all of Palestine. But they were in no way representative of established Islam. It was a sect and a perversion of Islam, and yet they used the technique of political murder to great effect with actual assassinations and attempted assassinations, including an attempt on Saladin himself. So instead of us thinking about Osama bin Laden as representative of anything in a broad scale, I think we need to think of him as an aberration who is really a direct descendant from the so-called old man of the mountain who presided over the assassins of the 12th century.
Well, Jim Rustin, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
James Rustin Jr. is the author of Warriors of God. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.